Monster Man, episode 247, Skunk to Slime, Olive. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we'll be taking a look at three, or maybe two, depending on how you count, monsters from the S chapter of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. Before we do that, though, it's time to thank a new Patreon sponsor. This is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like today's backer, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my other show, Patron Deities, in which I go through the Deities and Demigods supplement. And I talk about all the gods, monsters, and mythological beings in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology in your fantasy role-playing games. We're currently doing a series on Native American mythology, and of course, if you subscribe now, there's dozens of episodes that I've already done just waiting for you to listen to them. Anyway, thank you very much to today's new backer, Tichurel, or maybe Tichurel. Whichever way it is, thank you very much for your support of the show. It really means a lot to me. Alright, our first monster is the skunk. You know, this is one of a series of monsters that have been coming up recently where we've already had the giant version of this, because we had the skunk, giant before, or if it wasn't a skunk, giant, it was a very skunk-like monster. Yeah, maybe that's what I'm thinking of, like the wither stench from the Fiend Folio, the thing that smells so bad that your clothes can rot off. Skunks are a bit odd in that there's no reason that they shouldn't make sense in a fantasy setting, but most fantasy settings are kind of European, not just in the like the cultures that are based on them, but in the landscape that they have. So you get exceptions. So for example, Westeros is, you know, a medieval European culture set in a North American landscape, well, North and South American landscape, or The Winter of the World by Michael Scott Rohan. Some of those books are set in, you know, an analog North America. Well, a North America is set in the Ice Age and has, like, giant ground sloths and stuff. But in general, you don't get a lot of skunks or raccoons or possums or things like that. If you were describing the medieval fantasy world of Dungeons & Dragons and you said, oh, and then you see a kangaroo rat scurry past, you'd think that was weird, even though there's no reason that there shouldn't be, right? It's not actual Europe. And I like skunks. Skunks, along with all other creatures that smell bad, like skunks are the Ur creature that smells bad, because in real life, they smell absolutely terrible. It says in here that if a skunk sprays you, your clothes could smell so bad that you might have to bury them in order to avoid, like, giving off the nauseating reek of a skunk. And honestly, I don't know how people dealt with being skunk sprayed before washing machines existed. Leaving skunks well alone, I imagine, is the answer to that question. And I like the skunk for the same reason that I like all other smell-bad monsters, because it encourages sensory imagination in the game. If you get sprayed by a skunk, now you're thinking not just about, like, where the monster is in relationship to you, not just what things look like, not just what your character can hear, but also things like what it smells like. And that adds, like, a level of immersion to the setting. I think I've said this before about other smell-based monsters, but it continues to be true. I think the chances that you're going to have to, like, fight a skunk are pretty slim. I do think, so, like, imagine that you're moving into kind of an analog Americas region, and you have that staple of, like, early D&D low-level characters. You've got some dogs with you. Dogs are very useful tools for low-level adventures. They add a little combat potential. They got the good smelling and whatever. But dogs frequently do not know well enough to leave skunks alone. And that could definitely be something that could happen to your poor old dog in a D&D game, and I think it would be fun to see this party of tough adventurers, you know, giving their poor old doggo a bath in lemon juice. Or is it tomato juice? You're supposed to bathe in tomato juice to get skunk spray out. I think that's right. I've never been skunked, and I'm very pleased to keep it that way. The next creature on the list is the slime creature. Now, the slime creature is not really a monster by itself. It's something that is created by the slime, olive. So if the slime, olive lands on you, it can infect you and start to turn you into one of these slime creatures. So you're basically eventually going to become a big ambulatory slime colony, wandering around, not remembering your former life, hoping for nothing but to just, like, make up a part of the slime, olive's reproductive cycle, which is a pretty gross thing to have happen to you. This is a fine monster, and it would be a little more horrific if we hadn't already seen basically this setup before, because this is already more or less the fungus that creates the Vegapygmium. They have a similar relationship where they take over your body. I guess the Vegapygmies come from corpses, if I recall correctly, but that seems like a pretty minor difference. The slime, olive itself is the other component of this monstrous ecosystem. And what it does is that it drops down on you and it splats on your skin. It like clings to the ceiling of the dungeon. And when you pass underneath it, it drops down and tries to like basically go down your collar. Because its poison has a numbing effect, you might not notice that it's there. And everyone else in the party just gets one chance to notice that this thing is on you. And it basically starts growing on you and infecting you. Now, of course, if they see you, you know, nude, I suppose they would realize that you had this infection, which kind of leads me to the question, you know, I wonder how often that really happens, because it feels like a part of the game that is normally abstracted, or actually, I was going to say that, you know, maybe in order to avoid tipping your hand to the players that something is going on, you'd have to say like, okay, now tell me about your bathing routine, like you're on the march. This is like a big overland expedition. I mean, you're not sleeping in your armor, but by the same token, you're probably not stopping to get your kit off all the time, right? I can see that. At the same time, as I was telling the story, I remembered that the very first session of D&D that I ever played had a scene in a bathhouse, because I think I joined that game in its second session, or maybe I was just late and joined partway through the first session, and I was playing a half-orc cleric of St. Cuthbert. And when I arrived, the characters were staying at a monastery maybe or somewhere like that, a temple, and they had gone into the balneary and they were all taking a big bath together. And I remember that, you know, my character was like very fastidiously clean. So there was a whole bit based around whether someone had a nail brush that was going on before I arrived. And when I came in, you know, I was like, oh, sure, yeah, he just jumps and splashes down in, and he's there, and I, like, mimed cleaning my nails with a nail brush. And my wife, although we weren't married at the time, but my wife, who was playing with the other characters, saw this, and was like, see, I told you a civilized person would have a nail brush. So, in fact, you know, if you think about it, in ancient and medieval societies, bathing customs could often be the focus for a lot of interesting social interaction. And, for that matter, a bathhouse is a really great place to have a fight, right? You've got the slippery tiles, you've got the clouds of steam, you've got, you know, no weapons or armor, so you're just like hitting them with the benches or trying to shove them in the big pools of water. You got all kinds of stuff. If you haven't seen the film Eastern Promises and you don't mind really frightening and horrible fights, there is a scene where there's a fight, I want to say in like a steam bath, like a banya, with linoleum knives, and it's exactly what it sounds like. I guess that's not really related, just the idea of thinking of the situations where you might be able to tell that a character was infected led me to the idea of staging a big fight scene in a bathhouse, and now I'm gonna do it. Because why wouldn't you? I don't know that I have the patience to DM that game where essentially we're keeping track of all the aspects of this expedition, and like the cleric is giving people regular checkups, because the cleric is like the party's medical officer. I can see that that would be fun, like tracking the rations and thinking about the guard rota and all that kind of stuff. There's definitely a type of enjoyment to be had in that. I would play in that, but I don't know that I would have the patience to run it. I did run that Call of Cthulhu campaign, Beyond the Mountains of Madness, and although I think we had a very good time, I co-ran it with somebody else. Each of us played one of the two NPCs who run the expedition, so they could split off in different parties. But although I think that game went very well, I don't think the expedition management parts of it were the parts that are most fondly remembered. Certainly not the bits that I ran. Anyway, my point is simply that this is a monster that, in order to deal with it, you kind of have to have that stuff worked out, right? Your best bet of catching it, you catch it before the person becomes completely transformed into a slime creature, then, you know, there are ways of stopping it. But if you don't, then, you know, they're pretty much gone for good. And your odds of spotting it at the moment that the person is infected are basically a toss-up. But if they're undergoing some kind of regular medical examination, then your odds of catching it are like 100%. So is an interesting reminder of kind of like focusing on the daily life of a party traveling overland. I don't think you want to constantly have that, keeping track of that every session. I would find that dull. But I do think that having the occasional moment where you focus in on that can really enhance a game. So even though this monster is fine by itself, but kind of reminiscent of another monster we've already looked at, I actually really like it because I like the idea of this thing that over time infects and transforms someone. So, you know, if you know that those things are there, regular checkups are probably part of your routine, and that's a fun aspect to have in your game. Anyway, that's about all the monsters that we have time for today. This week we've got a special episode coming up in which we're going to talk about how to create recurring villains, and I'm really looking forward to it. And then in Friday's episode, we're going to be moving on in the S chapter of Monster Manual 2, and we're going to look at maybe the biggest gap in power level that we've had in a single episode. We're going to talk about the snake and the solar here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.